Good morning. The Lord be with you. I want to thank Dr. Lessing for putting together the schedule for our convocation speakers this year and for arranging for our speaker to be with us this morning. Speaking to us on the topic Antichrist, has the biblical evidence been left behind? Our speaker comes to us from the faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He graduated from that seminary in 1984, received his Master's of Theology degree from Princeton in 1985, served as parish pastor, associate, and then senior pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Traverse City, Michigan, receiving his PhD from the University of Michigan in 1995, and has served on the faculty at Concordia Fort Wayne since 1996, now serving as professor and chairman of the exegetical department. Would you please welcome Dr. Charles Geeshan.
I too want to thank Pastor Lessing for inviting me, and he told me as he emailed me last week, I invited you, then I'm skipping town. So maybe he was afraid of what I was going to say today, but but I want to thank him for the invitation and being able to also preach for your service today. It's a great joy to be with you, to see many of my colleagues from this seminary, as well as some former parishioners. Paul Philp, Pastor Philp, was one of my first confirmands up in Traverse City, and now is here as in the graduate program. What was that? No. But also, I want to publicly express my thanks to Jim Vells, Dr. James Vells, who actually is somewhat responsible for first getting me interested in this topic. Years and years ago, I think it was before I went out in the vicarage, I had a class in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and that's where it began. However, I, in my work, have gone much more in the direction of studying the central doctrine, Christ, and early Christology, but certainly it is an important foil for understanding the person of Christ is to understand the doctrine Antichrist in the Scriptures. So that's our topic today. I hope you have an outline. I will not be going through all of the material on the outline, but at least gives you a sense of the lay of the land, so to speak, but I'll focus primarily on the New Testament evidence for the reality of Antichrist, and with some introductory comments, some very brief comments on the Old Testament and Jewish literature, and some brief comments on confessing Antichrist today. In spite of the horrors of the Holocaust, two world wars, and several other wars, we in the United States have done our best to insulate and protect our lives from the devastating reality of Satan. Some of the more recent events in our country's history have certainly pressed that whole issue, have really chipped away at that insulating that we do. The events of September 11th, the kind of carnage that we see coming from Iraq, all of these images certainly remind us of the reality of evil and Satan. Andrew DeBelko, as he introduces his 1995 book, The Death of Satan, How Americans Have Lost the Sense of Evil, writes, and this is a rather extensive quotation, but I think it'll help put what I'm saying in context. He writes, "A gulf has opened up in our culture between the visibility of evil and the intellectual resources available for coping with it. Never before have images of horror been so widely disseminated and so appalling, from organized death camps to children starving in famines that might have been averted. Rarely does a week go by without newspaper and television accounts of teenagers performing contract killings for a few dollars, women murdered on the street for their purses or their furs, young men shot in the head for keys to their Jeep, and these are only the domestic bulletins. The repertoire of evil has become richer. Yet never have our responses been so weak. We have no language for connecting our sinner lives with the horrors that pass before our eyes in the outer world. Philanthropy and protest seem empty gestures, arbitrary in their choice of beneficiary or occasion. For the infant Americans 350 years ago, evil had a name, a face, and an explanation. It was called the Fall. It was personified in the devil, and it was attributed to an original sin committed in Eden and imputed by God to all mankind. When American culture began, this devil was an incandescent presence in most people's lives, a symbol and explanation for both the cruelties one received and those perpetuated upon others. But by 1700, he was already losing his grip on the imagination, a process that has continued ever since and that has left us, in the words of the psychologist Henry Murray, with a Satan who is no more than a vestige image, a broken-spirited relic of a perished past, a ludicrous ham actor with no greater part to play in man's imagination than the appendix in his gut. James Moorhead, an historian at Princeton Theological Seminary, who specializes in the eschatology of American Christianity, has stated the problem in a similar manner. Evil comes as a monstrous moral alien that cannot be incorporated into the prevailing culture. And because it cannot be assimilated, horror returns. It moves in an endless loop. It fails to satisfy intellectually because liberal humanitarianism offers no way of articulating or transcending major acts of human transgression. In its eschatology, mainstream Protestantism has suppressed the blood, the chaos, and the terror of the apocalypse, and these have leapt out like the boogeyman from under the bed. If the mainstream churches cannot give a satisfactory account of the end, is it surprising that many people will choose to go elsewhere where those needs can be met and addressed? I would argue that the scriptures themselves provide us with a worldview and a language to interpret the reality of evil around us and in us, and one of the ways they do that is in the portrait of the reality of Antichrist. For example, Richard Balcom, who recognizes this important function of the book of Revelation, as he states, and I quote, "It," namely the book of Revelation, "recognizes the dominant the way a dominant culture with its images and ideals constructs the world for us so that we perceive and respond to the world in its terms. Moreover, it unmasks this dominant construction of the world as an ideology of the powerful which serves to maintain their power. In its place, Revelation offers a different way of perceiving the world which leads people to resist and challenge the effects of the dominant ideology. The church is always called to be countercultural." End of quote. The portrait of Antichrist that we find in the scriptures, however, is not a simple one. Christians have sometimes strayed from the biblical witness by focusing on one individual Antichrist, the Antichrist. And if you remember the Left Behind movie that you saw over and over again, it was Nicolay. Or even limiting Antichrist to exclusively the Roman Catholic papacy, such as we find among some fellow Lutherans. This study of Antichrist teaching in the scriptures will demonstrate that there are two interrelated aspects to the biblical evidence. First, the teaching about the broader work of Satan in opposing the confession of Christ, and the teaching about the specific end-time manifestation of the ultimate false Christ, who will oppose Christ and finally be destroyed by him upon his parousia or return. This delicate balance between these two aspects of biblical teaching about Antichrist was eloquently confessed by John of Damascus, and this is on your outline right at the top. "Everyone who does not confess the Son of God, that the Son of God is God, come in flesh, and that he who is perfect God also became perfect man while remaining God, is Antichrist. Nevertheless, in a peculiar and special way is that one called Antichrist who comes at the consummation of the age. Moving with that basic focus, I'm going to move into the New Testament evidence and show how several of these texts maintain that balance of both seeing a wider reality of Antichrist, the work of Satan, as well as speaking of a singular final manifestation, the Antichrist, so to speak. First of all, New Testament evidence for the reality of Antichrist. Although several important Old Testament antecedents shape the teaching about Antichrist in the early Christianity, the New Testament evidence is by far what forms the scriptural foundation for this doctrine within the life of the church. Well, when examining this New Testament evidence, the tendency is to point to Paul as the earliest New Testament testimony to the teaching. This examination of evidence, however, will begin with Jesus' teaching on the subject. Any of you who know David Scair, both my colleague and mentor, know that that kind of emphasis is a genealogical one that's inherited from him. Namely, even if all four Gospels post-date Paul's Thessalonian correspondence, as is generally held by many New Testament scholars, the oral teaching of Jesus that was the basis for much early preaching and teaching was nevertheless probably also a significant source for teaching about Antichrist within the earliest church, even for Paul in his epistles. After looking at the, and John, obviously, after looking at the evidence in the Gospels, focusing primarily on Matthew 24, which will warm Dr. Gibbs' heart, the important New Testament text on this subject, namely in Paul's letter to the second letter to the Thessalonians, as well as in the Johannine epistles, and briefly also in the book of Revelation, those will be examined. First of all, the eschatological discourse of Jesus. The primary evidence for Jesus' teaching about those who would oppose him in the latter days is found in his eschatological discourse, namely Matthew 24, verses 3 to 31, and then with parallel accounts in Mark 13 and in Luke 21. Since Matthew contains the most extensive discourse, it will serve as the primary text that I briefly examine here. Especially important for early teaching about Antichrist is Jesus' instruction about false Christ, plural there, as expressed in Matthew 24, verse 5, verse 11, and also verses 23 and 24. I'll just read those briefly so they're on your radar screen, especially if you don't have a text before you. Verse 4, "And Jesus answered and said to them, 'See to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many.'" Jumping down to verse 11 of chapter 24, "And many false prophets will arise and will mislead many." And then jumping down to verses 23 and 24, "Then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe him. For false Christ and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect." There are several important features in Jesus' instruction in this discourse that shaped subsequent teaching about Antichrist. Notice I don't use the definite article, okay, because I want to keep that whole discussion a little broader, so about Antichrist. First, the description of imposters of Jesus as pseudo-Christoi, false Christ, may have influenced the choice of the title Antichrist in the Johannine epistles, a label that became the dominant title of choice in the history of Christian doctrine. A semantic shift from pseudo-Christoi to anti-Christoi is a rather logical development to clarify the identity of these individuals as part of the kingdom of Satan. The question naturally arises, if these figures are not Christ, since they are false Christ, then who are they? They are not some neutral imitators of Christ, but opponents of Christ, namely those diametrically against him, antichristoi. A second significant feature of Jesus' discourse is the plurality of these imposters. There is not merely one false Christ, but many false Christ, for many, poloi, will come in my name saying, I am the Christ. Matthew 24, verse 5. One of the sharp differences between Jesus' eschatological teaching and later teaching about Antichrist is the focus of the latter on a single false Christ. Although a single eschatological figure is an aspect of this discourse that will be discussed below, the plurality of false Christ is the more dominant theme. This plurality of opponents is also emphasized with the parallel testimony about pseudo-prophetai, false prophets, not just a singular false prophet, who will mislead many, even as false Christs mislead many. A third feature of Jesus' teaching is a description of what these false Christs will claim in asserting their identity as the Christ. Jesus says, many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ. What is the referent of the epito onomati mu, in my name, that Jesus speaks of here? Jesus is probably alluding to the understanding that he is the possessor of the divine name. And this understanding is clear, certainly, in the Gospel of John. He says things like, I have come in my Father's name, but you did not receive me. This signifies that many will come claiming to be the true possessor of the divine name, or Yahweh incarnate. This understanding is also supported by the pronouncement made by these imitators according to the account of this discourse in Mark and Luke, where they actually claim, ego I me, much as Yahweh uses that kind of self-disclosure in the end of Deuteronomy and in it's dominant in the second half of Isaiah. Fourth, Jesus states that these false Christs will also assert their identity as the true Christ by doing great signs and wonders. Verse 24 in Matthew 24. This is similar to the description Paul gives of the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2:9. This phrase, along with earlier explicit references to the abomination that causes desolation, namely in verse 15, both point to Daniel as the source for some of Jesus' teaching here. Also significant for understanding the mystery of lawlessness and the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2 is the result of this messianic imitation as described by Jesus in verse 12. He notes that because of this activity, he says, dia ta plethunai, anomion, namely because lawlessness, anomion, will be increased because of this. So this activity will lead to lawlessness. Although this is probably not the source of Paul's use of anomia, namely lawless, it is nevertheless demonstrates the use of this idea and term in other traditions concerning those who oppose Christ in the last days. A fifth feature of this eschatological teaching is the close relationship between false prophets and false Christ. Much like false Christ, false prophets will be numerous in the latter days and will mislead many. Jesus' use of pseudo-prophetai is based upon his audience familiarity with Old Testament usage. These false prophets, however, include anyone who proclaims falsehood. What distinguishes false Christ from false prophets is the claim to be Christ. What the relationship between false Christ and prophets in this discourse and the portrait of the two beasts in Revelation chapter 13 is intriguing, because there you have the first beast called really he's a false Christ figure. The second one is actually called the false prophet. So it's a very intriguing relationship there. Again, though, and if I have time, I'll discuss this, but in Revelation 13, you have one image just including the plurality of false Christ and false prophets. One image, just one beast, and the other is a second beast. It includes that whole reality of the many false Christ and many false prophets. Another feature of Jesus' instruction is the ability of these false Christ and false prophets to mislead many. The seriousness of this threat is emphasized by Jesus when he states that they pose a temptation to even the elect. That's in verse 24. Testimony to apostasy within the followers of Jesus is a prominent feature in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3. But Paul teaches about a final and climactic misleading of Christians shortly before the parousia, which he refers to as apostasis, namely apostasia, the apostasy. So not just several, misleadings, but one final one. A seventh and final feature of this instruction is the focus on a single significant event or figure. And here, an interesting element of the discourse in Matthew 24 is the reference to the abomination that causes desolation, chapter 24, verse 15, that will signal the coming of the end. This phrase is borrowed from Daniel, very similar phrase in the Septuagint, where it foretells of the desecration of the altar of burnt offering in the temple by Antiochus IV in 167 BC. There has been significant discussion about the historical referent of this abomination, as your own Dr. Gibbs has done in his book, Jerusalem and Parousia, and that this event that Jesus is speaking of points to the desecration and destruction of the temple by the Romans in AD 70. All I'll say here in terms of the Antichrist doctrine is the understanding of the singular Antichrist is probably influenced in some manner by this type of teaching about a future eschatological event that will pose serious challenges for Christ followers, especially related to the temple. Moving on, the Thessalonian correspondence of Paul. Even though eschatology is a very significant theme in several of Paul's letters, the only place where he discusses an end-time imposter of Christ is in 2 Thessalonians 2:1-12. Obviously, the context for the whole discussion is important. The problem was confusion about whether the end time had dawned or not, and one of the ways that Paul clears it up is pulling his whole understanding of the end time events about an end time imposter off the shelf and putting it into this epistle and reminding them, indeed, I have taught this, and so I'm reiterating this. And because you haven't seen this end time imposter yet, the last day has not dawned yet. And he writes, and here I'll read the text. It's rather important in terms of the overall doctrine, verses 1 through 12. Now we request you, brethren, with regard to the coming of our Lord Jesus, that our gathering together to him, that you may not be quickly shaken from your composure or be disturbed either by a spirit or a message or a letter as if it was from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come, namely the day of the Lord, unless or until the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Do you not remember that while I was still with you, I was telling you these things? And you know what restrains him now, so that in his time he may be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, only he who now restrains until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming, his parousia. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they believe what is false, in order that they all may be judged who did not believe the truth but took pleasure in wickedness. Several features of this text are important for any discussion of Antichrist teaching, even though obviously the word Antichristos is nowhere to be found. First, Paul testifies to an already established teaching, probably one that he indeed taught, but probably also had wider coverage in the apostolic church, namely that there will be a single figure whose revelation will cause apostasy shortly before the last day arrives. And we see here especially the interesting use of Daniel 11. And here I put on your Old Testament text, Daniel 11, 36 to 45, where in a nice little article, one of our own Missouri Synod professors, Dr. Andrew Steinman, has written about the fact that it's best to understand a shift in Daniel 11 from the prophet speaking about Antiochus in the near future to an eschatological impostor king in chapter 11, verses 36 to 45, which is rather traditional in the history of the interpretation, but had certainly been undercut in more recent years in the study of Daniel. Here, Paul clearly links this man of lawlessness with Satan and even sees him as a manifestation of Satan. Second, there is no one exclusive title for this eschatological figure. I repeat that. There's no just one title. It's not just called the man of lawlessness. Paul calls him both ho anthropos tes anomios, namely the man of lawlessness. He also calls him ho huios tes apolaios, namely the son of destruction. And then he refers to him simply as ho animus, the lawless one, in chapter 2, verse 8. So this term, anomias, lawlessness, may have come from Jesus' teaching about the impact of false prophets on the church causing lawlessness, but it's more probable that it was Paul's adaptation in Greek of a prominent Aramaic title for Satan's manifestations in Jewish literature. You see, and Paul gives evidence of this in 2 Corinthians, calling one of the titles he uses for the manifestation of Satan is Belial. And there's a very strong tradition in Jewish literature about Belial or Beliar. And this is an interesting term in terms of its etymology, and certainly probably related just to this lawlessness or wickedness or worthless. Literally means worthless one, you know. So that's probably some of where the influence came for that title, lawless one. Third, Paul teaches that this one will deceive many and cause a significant apostasy within the church. This teaching is certainly similar to the teaching of Jesus, but Paul focuses on a singular end-time apostasy caused by the final false Christ, because his pastoral purpose is to assure the Thessalonian congregation that the last day has not yet dawned. A fourth feature of Paul's eschatological teaching is that the man of lawlessness will be destroyed by Christ at his parousia, his return. And he writes, "And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming." Paul draws on Isaiah to emphasize that this future and final false Messiah, false Christ, will be destroyed upon Christ's return. Paul assures the Thessalonian congregation that the last day could not have dawned if the lawless one has not been both manifest and destroyed. A final and often overlooked feature of this pericope is that Paul also speaks of the broader work of Satan already active but being restrained. And here I would like to emphasize this point because it fits nicely with what I said earlier. Everybody focuses on the man of lawlessness and kind of ignores the fact that Paul talks about the mystery of lawlessness already at work. So he not only speaks about the future man of lawlessness, but also of the present mystery of lawlessness, mysterion, namely the mystery of lawlessness already happening. The use of the same genitive modifier, tais anomias, of lawlessness, indicates an organic relationship between the mystery and the man presented here. The reason Paul places more emphasis on the final singular eschatological figure, the man, is his overall purpose, which is to assure the Thessalonian congregation that the last day has not yet arrived. If he'd be talking to us, he'd probably give much more attention to the mystery already at work. You know, wake up, pay attention, identify that reality. You don't just sit back and think you have everything, you know, mapped out. The teaching of the Johannine epistles. Here we're waiting for Dr. Schuchert's commentary, so I'll keep my comments very brief. But nevertheless, obviously, it's extremely important, the testimony there. The technical title, Antichristos and Antichristoi, is found in the singular and plural, obviously, solely in John's first two epistles. As with Paul, John is not creating this tradition. That's an important point. He's not creating this tradition with the writing of these epistles. He is teaching the same truth that had been preached already in the church. What does he say? In chapter 2, verse 18, just as you heard that Antichrist is coming. So he's now writing about it. They had already heard about it in his preaching of the apostles. He's simply reiterating it here in his epistles. And those three pericopes that do discuss Antichrist are obviously found in chapter 2, 18 to 23, then again in chapter 4, especially in verse 3. And I'll just read some of the key words here from those two pericopes. Children, it is the last hour. Just as you heard that Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrist have arisen. From this we know it is the last hour. Okay, and then he concludes that little section, verse 22. Who is the liar but the one who denies that Jesus is the Christ? Little explanation of who is Antichrist. And then chapter 4, verse 1, he says, Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. Notice that language of false prophets. By this you know the spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God, and every spirit that does not confess Jesus is not from God. And this is the spirit of Antichrist, which you have heard that he is coming, and now he is already in the world. Okay. So, and then a little bit later, interestingly, he also talks about knowing the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. 2 John 7 also mentions this. For many deceivers have come out into the world, those who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Watch yourselves, so that you might not lose what we have accomplished, but that you may have full reward. Okay. The teaching found in the Johannine epistles, although not as detailed as Paul, is noteworthy because it includes a basic definition of who is to be labeled as Antichrist. One who denies that Jesus is the Christ, one who denies the Father and the Son, and one who does not confess that Jesus is the Christ. That's the various ways. As well as one who does not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. John talks about Antichrist as both a singular future reality as well as a plural present reality, talks about Antichrist is coming, and many Antichrist have arisen. Although the Antichrist and plural Antichrist are distinguished by John, they certainly aren't separated. They're part of the same reality. In spite of the prominence of the Antichrist title in 1 and 2 John, there are other ways that John speaks about this reality. And I think here especially noteworthy is the two ways that he mentioned, namely the spirit of truth associated with the paraclete, especially in the gospel, and the spirit of error, who is associated with the reality of Satan. And we should realize that there's not a big jump. Anybody who is familiar with angelomorphic Christology knows that there's not a huge jump between talking about a spirit and an angel. You know, Satan as the angel of error or spirit of error. And he's already in the world. I'm not going to comment, in order to allow some time for discussion, I'm not going to comment much on the vision of the two beasts in the book of Revelation, but I will comment on it very briefly. Although Paul's testimony to Antichrist is early and extensive, the most memorable description of the, quote, reality of Antichrist in the New Testament is the portrait of the first beast in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation presents a portrait of an anti-trinity with the dragon functioning as a parody of the Father, the first beast as a parody of the Son, and the second beast, also called the false prophet, as a parody of the Holy Spirit. And obviously, chapter 13, the whole chapter really works through, especially the manifestation of the two beasts. This portrait, especially of the first beast, is founded upon the imagery of the book of Daniel and actually kind of rolls it all into one figure. You know, the different kingdoms and the different descriptions given to these visible descriptions of these kings, they're all rolled into one reality in Revelation 13. The understanding of a singular figure is prominent here, but this singular beast is not a simple reality. He is in league with the dragon and the false prophet. It's very difficult to harmonize what you see in Revelation 13 with just the man of lawlessness or just the Antichrist in the Johannine epistles. I would argue that just as so often is true with the book of Revelation, it takes a broad historical reality and boils it down into one scene. For example, chapter 7, we were talking about a little bit last night at the fireside chat in one of your non-fireside rooms. We were talking about the fact that in chapter 7, you have the sealing of the entire church militant, which happens generation after generation, century after century, through holy baptism. It's all boiled down in one scene, just a few verses, the sealing of the 144,000. You know, so what goes on, you know, over a historical period. All, you know, one quick blip, just like Jesus' whole incarnation, life, death, resurrection is just a one verse in chapter 12. You know, the woman gives birth, and the child is caught up, okay? You know, a quick overview of Christ's work, probably one of the shortest ones in the scriptures. So also here in Revelation 13, a very, very broad and complex reality of Satan's work in the world, of false Christ and false prophets, all boiled down into this one picture of the first beast and the second beast. Again, you have a very important part of the portrait, though, is that the second beast, the false prophet, is the one who does signs and wonders. Interestingly, you know, that's a big part of the element of the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2. The relationship of the first beast to the emperor Nero, both through the physical description of the wound to the neck and through the numerology, 666, helps the reader to identify this figure as already manifest and not solely a future eschatological figure, even though, obviously, the reality of Antichrist and anti-spirit will be with us until the very eschaton. The future destruction of the first beast and the false prophet is clearly testified to at the end of the apocalypse, where when Christ comes on the scene, chapter 19, you then see both that first beast as well as the false prophet, the second beast, thrown into the lake of the fire, never to be heard from again. Summary. Here I would simply say, in spite of some of these differences, we do have a complementary. And here I'm not just running roughshod trying to harmonize everything. You appreciate some of the distinctives of each of these New Testament texts, but there is some complementary testimony. It was stated that this examination of evidence will demonstrate that there are two interrelated aspects to the biblical evidence: the teaching about the broader work of Satan in opposing the confession of Christ in a plurality of ways, and the teaching about the specific end-time manifestation of the ultimate false Christ who will be destroyed upon Christ's parousia. Jesus' eschatological teaching, which formed an important basis for later apostolic teaching, put significant emphasis on the plurality of false Christ who will appear in the latter days and mislead many. The texts from 2 Thessalonians and 1 and 2 John testify to this complex antichrist reality that entails both the broad and ongoing attack of Satan against the church in various people and events in every generation of these latter days, using such terms as false Christ, spirit of antichrist, antichrist, mystery of lawlessness already at work, as well as testifying to an individual satanic manifestation or figure who will be manifest shortly before the parousia to be annihilated by Christ at his return. And there we see terms like the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness, the son of destruction, the lawless one. Now, just very briefly, again, I'll comment that the importance of Old Testament traditions, especially, namely Old Testament evidence, especially from Daniel, for early Christian teaching about the Antichrist. I mentioned that earlier, and since I don't have time, I'm not going to go through, but I did list on your outline some of these key texts in the Old Testament that really form an important basis for this discussion. I also list examples in some of the Jewish literature of where you see some of this Old Testament teaching carried forward into the first century. And I even put also an example of where what we see in some of the Old Testament text and some of the New Testament text continues in a very Jewish way in the ascension of Isaiah, which is obviously postdates Thessalonians and probably influenced a little bit by Paul's letter there. But also, you know, certainly that this continued to be on the radar screen in the way that early Christians are teaching it. One text that I think is very important that I alluded to but didn't cite is Isaiah 11:4. And literally there, and again, think about how ancient this is, you know, long before any of this language comes in the New Testament, you have, "And he," namely the Messiah, the Ebed, the servant, "will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked one." And this is kind of the basis, then, for this understanding of a false Messiah or opposer to the legitimate Messiah that will be slain in the latter days. Okay, I will then just skip over that with just reading a conclusion. These are the words of William Horbury from his study on Antichrist among Jews and Gentiles. He writes, "Antichrist, then, was certainly an important early Christian conception. Nevertheless, the Christian references to him include much to suggest that, like the figure of the Christ or Messiah in Old Testament and Jewish hopes, he," namely John, "as well as other Christians, derived this conception from pre-Christian Judaism in its Greek and Roman setting. This view is consonant with the lack of an explanation of the Antichrist figure in the New Testament, and it is supported by Jewish sources from the end of the Second Temple period, which describe an Antichrist-like figure without using this term, naming him rather the Wicked One, Gog or Belial. Now, I'd like to jump forward, and one could spend considerable time at this point in asking how this biblical evidence fits within our Lutheran confessions as we confess Antichrist today. I could simply refer to Dr. Aaron's fine article on the subject or to Dr. Stevenson's comments in his eschatology volume. One thing must be stated explicitly. Some Lutherans have a narrower understanding of Antichrist than that of the confessions or even Luther. Stevenson makes this important observation, and I quote, "Confessional Lutheran theology makes certain qualifications with respect to the identification made of the papacy with Antichrist. First, it is conceded that the papacy does not exhaust the mystery of Antichrist, but that it embodies the most intense manifestation of the mystery thus far encountered in the history of the church." End of quote. To harmonize our confessional stand with the biblical evidence, it would be most proper, again, I'm just advocating this, to say that the papacy has been and certainly remains, even more so in many respects than from the time of the Reformation, against Christ and is a clear manifestation, as Stevenson says, even the most clear manifestation of the mystery of lawlessness already at work and of the plurality of Antichrist who manifest themselves in each generation. It is certainly, therefore, necessary to both maintain the confession of the papacy as Antichrist and also be ever alert to other ways that Antichrist are manifest or that the final Antichrist will be manifest. This last point, Hermann Sasse, in his article on Antichrist, really, I think, does a fine job in this point of discussion. He and I'll give you one quotation from that article. He says, "The Lutheran Church teaches nothing in its confessions as to how God may let the prophecy of the Antichrist come to fulfillment in the hidden terrors of the end time. What our confessions can teach and do teach, this and no more, that in the last time which we can see, in the time of the church until the present day, the prophecy of the Antichrist has found fulfillment in the papacy." Not only the papacy, but certainly also in the papacy. Edmund Schlink, in his work on the theology of the Lutheran confessions, makes a statement that, I want to say, I do not like the way he phrases it. So, you know, don't immediately call Dean Wenthe and say, Gieschen's a heretic here. He's talking about the scripture or the confessions as paradigm rather than as dogma. No, I don't like the way Schlink puts it here. Okay, but he does make an interesting and important point as he concludes, and I'll read this. "All of this leads," and he's talking about the confessions testimony of the Antichrist, "to the conclusion that the eschatological judgments of the confessions, in spite of all distinctness, are made still in the cautious groping and questioning of the time regarding the scripturally attested signs of the last day. Therefore, we shall have to weigh carefully to what extent," and again, this is what's going to make you nervous here, guys, "these historically conditioned statements about the Antichrist are to be understood as dogma or as paradigm." Okay? Again, I don't agree with that. Just listen on. "To understand them as paradigm would mean to regard them as a model of how to take seriously the Lord's directive that we should look in the present moment of every age for harbingers of the end. In this case, the statements about the essence of Antichrist would have a more binding significance than the judgments about the Pope as Antichrist. At all events," and this is actually the most important statement, It must be said that the church becomes unfaithful to the confessions if it views the pope alone or the papacy alone as the Antichrist, instead of being ever alert in constant watchfulness for the signs of Antichrist in each current generation. Although this last point is an important one to take to heart, not only because of the confessions, but because of the biblical witness itself. And again, being alert and testifying to the reality of Antichrist in every generation, including in the papacy, but also beyond the papacy, and certainly especially within the life of the church, even as the papacy is active within the life of the church. Finally, and we'll open it up for questions here very shortly, the doctrine of Antichrist in the scriptures helps us to unmask the reality of evil and show it for what it really is, the work of Satan that will come to a very dreadful end with his ultimate deceptive manifestation and then utter destruction at the hands of our returning Lord in his parousia. Here, I think one can say, we don't know definitively who is this final manifestation of Antichrist really until the eschaton. Until then, we are alert and ever pointing to Antichrist or pseudo-Christ already manifest. And here, the pointed words of Cyril of Jerusalem are very helpful. They're on your outline. So be warned, my friend, I have given you the signs of the Antichrist. Do not merely store them up in your memory. Pass them on to everyone without stint. If you have a child after the flesh, teach them to him forthright. And if you have become a godparent, forewarn your godchild, lest he should take the false Christ for the true. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. One final point. Any teaching of Antichrist is to serve our teaching of the Christ. We are not in a dualistic struggle between good and evil. Christ and Satan are not two gods duking it out in the end times. Christ is Yahweh as creator incarnate who has defeated his rebellious creation, including all fallen angels, in his own obedient life, death, and resurrection. This we must proclaim until his victory over Satan and all the forces of evil is consummated in his return. Thank you.